Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie reading the Big Bend Sentinel, January 21st, 2021. Brush fire prompts evacuations in Presidio, by Stephen Paulson. Presidio. A patch of brush on the south outskirts of Presidio went up in flames on Sunday, burning around 5 acres before firefighters were able to put it out. The fire, which started around 2:30 p.m., burned for around 2 hours, prompting evacuations of an unknown number of houses in the area. Numerous agencies responded to the inferno, including U.S. Customs and Border Protection and Bomberos Ojinaga, the Ojinaga Fire Department. The fire was initially discovered by some Border Patrol agents who were patrolling near the Rio Grande, said Greg Davis, a CBP spokesperson. The agency contacted the Presidio Volunteer Fire Department, who responded and took over scene command. CBP weren't active in the firefighting per se, Davis said, but they nonetheless helped respond to the incident, helping with traffic control in the area and evacuating residents in the fire exclusion zone. Adrian Flores, a volunteer firefighter in Presidio, said that due to dry conditions, the fire went up in about 10 minutes, quickly ripping through thick brush of mesquite and river cane. "We were just lucky that it wasn't really that windy," Flores said. Firefighters took defensive measures, helping to keep the fire from spreading to nearby homes. "Our main concern was the residents," Flores said. Flores thanked other agencies for helping respond to the fire. The Presidio Volunteer Fire Department has around a dozen members, he said, but the firefighters have jobs, are in high school, and can't always immediately respond to an incident. "It is very rare for a fire to get big enough to prompt calls to Ojinaga," Flores said. The last time the Bomberos Ojinaga responded to a fire in Presidio was in 2019, when a large grass fire started near Alamito Creek, east of the city. John Ferguson, the Presidio mayor, was getting ready for a bike ride with his wife Lucy when he first spotted the fire. He soon got a call from Saul Pardo, Presidio fire chief. He said, "Hey, do you suppose we could get the Ojinaga Fire Department over?" Ferguson recalled. Pardo did not respond to a request for comment by press time. By press time, it's unclear how exactly the fire started. Facing drought conditions, Presidio County is under a near-constant burn ban. The Presidio Police Department, who also responded to the fire, currently has no criminal investigations on the fire's origin, Police Chief Jose Cabezuela said on Monday. Regardless, the spot where the fire started, a patch of brush near Presidio High School, is frequently used by residents to dump trash, he said. Flores, the volunteer firefighter, said fire officials were also still working out how the fire started. "There are farms in the area, and it's possible the fire was started by someone trying to clear brush," he said. "There were no approved controlled burns in the area that day." But Flores said it was also possible that the fire started without human involvement. "There are some old irrigation generators in that area that could have contributed to the fire," though he stressed fire officials weren't sure. "There's too many variables," he said. "I don't want to speculate." Sunday's burn marks the second fire near Presidio in recent weeks. On the evening of December 28th, the Presidio Fire Volunteer Fire Department also responded to a fire around 10 miles west of Presidio. In that case, Flores said, the fire apparently started after farmers in Mexico were clearing brush. At a narrow point of the Rio Grande, the fire happened to start in Mexico, and with a little wind, it just topped over, Flores said of that incident. After warning, Texas continues use of curative tests. Texas will keep using curative mouth swab tests, mirroring other officials who are balancing an FDA warning about false negatives against the company's otherwise good track record, by Stephen Paulson. Texas. The Texas Division of Emergency Management, a state agency tasked with coordinating public coronavirus testing sites, is standing behind the Curative brand mouth swab test, at least for now. Curative, whose tests were used for months at public testing sites in the Tri-County, is facing scrutiny after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration warned of the risk of false negatives with the test. The Big Bend Sentinel reported on that warning last week. In emails to the Big Bend Sentinel, a TDEM spokesperson said the agency would continue working with vendors who utilize curative tests to ensure that Texans have access to a wide variety of COVID-19 testing options. The agency would also monitor any findings and data released by curative and the FDA, the spokesperson said. The FDA's warning, the spokesperson said, does not recommend discontinuing use of these tests. The spokesperson also included a statement from Curative, which stressed that a negative test result does not exclude the possibility of COVID-19 and that potential inaccuracies such as increased false negatives can occur. The news comes as government agencies across the country have grappled with how best to respond to the FDA's warning about false negatives, particularly among asymptomatic people being tested. Some governmental organizations, including Los Angeles County, have cut ties with the company. Many others, including TDEM, have said they will keep using the test. The Big Bend region relied on curative tests for months, but recently, state-run testing sites in the area have used a different test supply by DOCS Health. The emergency use authorization, EUA, that Curative received from the FDA last year says the proven efficacy of Curative's tests is limited to symptomatic individuals within 14 days of COVID-19 symptom onset. But officials across the country have also offered the test to people without symptoms, including at a public testing site in the Tri-County area last year. That discrepancy is apparently what prompted the FDA's warning. Though the agency has not responded to questions from the Big Bend Sentinel about its warning or the Curative EUA. Critics of the FDA, including Los Angeles Mayor and Curative supporter Eric Garcetti, have argued that the agency did not provide data that would justify discontinuing the use of the test. In a statement to the Big Bend Sentinel last week, Curative argued its positivity rate largely agrees with other labs. Before the controversy, California-based Curative had won over Big Bend residents with its ability to quickly deliver results. Tri-County officials, including at Sol Ross and in the city of Presidio, purchased batches of curative tests for use on groups like first responders and students. In the wake of the FDA warning, local officials are debating whether possible inaccuracies are enough reason to cancel contracts with the company. And for many, including officials at TDEM, the answer, for now at least, is no. Set to debut in March, new transmigrant route leaves Presidio preparing. By Abby Perot, Stephen Paulson, Presidio. Once a major topic in Presidio, the issue of transmigrants fell by the wayside last year as city officials scrambled to respond to coronavirus. But now, as the Big Bend Sentinel reported last week, the topic is back on the radar after the Mexican government in December officially announced the new route in its Diario Oficial de Federación, the Mexican equivalent of Federal Register. That announcement was short on details, but in a short section on baggage and allowance, rules for transmigrants, Mexican officials said that transmigrants would now be processed by customs officials in Ojinaga. The announcement said these rules would go into effect in 3 months, indicating that the route could debut as early as March. The Los Indios Matamoros port, currently the only approved route for transmigrants, would also remain open to the merchants, the announcement said. Adan Gonzalez, a transmigrant, was making his way through West Texas last week. For the past 3 years, he's heard rumors but no confirmations about the route change. In the past, Mexican officials have changed the port where you can pass, said Gonzalez, who spent 23 years transporting goods between the United States and his home country of Belize. But you always pass through just one. Adding Presidio without removing Los Indios will make the first time Gonzalez has had a chance to choose which port to use. On both sides of the Presidio-Ojinaga border, brokers are preparing for a mix of new customers and new competition. Port officials are preparing for a potential influx in traffic. And city officials in Presidio are once again figuring out how to respond in hopes of getting the new route delayed or canceled altogether. At a city council meeting last week, when transmigrants showed up on the agenda, people at the meeting could not hide their disappointment. "Oh no," one person on an audio recording of the meeting said. "Here we go again." Another attendee opined that, I thought the transmigrant issue had gone away. Transmigrants are traveling merchants from Central America who purchase consumer goods in the United States and resell them back home. The merchants aren't allowed to sell those goods in Mexico, and the country tightly regulates the industry, funneling transmigrants onto certain routes and cataloging their goods as they enter and leave the country. Currently, the only transmigrant route runs through Los Indios, a South Texas town where the traveling merchants dominate the local economy and civic life. At least 10 brokerage and depot businesses in tiny Los Indios, population 850, cater to my transmigrants. The city even celebrates a Día del Transmigrante, or Day of the Transmigrant. Rick Cavazos, the mayor of Pro Tem of Los Indios, told the Big Bend Sentinel in 2019 that transmigrants were an important part of the local economy. A truck stop used by transmigrants was by far the largest sales tax driver for the city, he said. But transmigrants also present challenges to the city, including traffic accidents and frequent long waits at the port. Over years of meetings, Presidio city officials have made it clear where they stand on the new proposed transmigrant route. Officials worry the new route could overwhelm local services, slow down the port, and bring crime to the region, as cartels prey on the traveling merchants. Gonzalez, the transmigrant from Belize, said it is dangerous on the Mexican side of Los Indios, where he has been stopped and extorted for money. They say it's organized crime, but you don't ask who they are, he said. The set price is 2,000 pesos, around $100 USD. If they stop you, you don't hesitate to give them money, he said. If you hesitate, they might get more aggressive. It's not worth dying for $100. When asked if the port opening to transmigrants in Presidio could lead to a rise in crime in Ojinaga, Gonzalez was blunt. Most likely, he said. At best, Presidio city officials would like to see the route canceled altogether. And at the very least, they want better communication with Mexican, Texan, and U.S. officials to make sure Presidio is ready for any influx of new commercial traffic. As early as 2017, when rumors of a new route were just starting to bubble up in Presidio, the city passed an ordinance regulating transmigrant traffic. It imposes regulations on the drivers, including barring them from parking in residential areas. Last March, the city went further, passing a resolution opposing the new route. The resolution cited a number of factors, including a lack of overnight accommodations for transmigrant traffic and the fact that U.S. Highway 67 is mainly two-lane, curvy, and hilly roadway. It urged Marfa and Presidio County to pass similar resolutions and encouraged the U.S. federal government to pay attention to local opposition. Few concrete developments came out of last week's meeting, and City Council took no action. Regardless, city officials made it clear that they still oppose the route. I still stand the same way, said Councilmember Rogelio Zubia. Mayor John Ferguson likewise said that his feelings were still the same as well. City Attorney Rod Ponta noted that the City Council is already on record as saying, y'all oppose it. He urged city officials to contact higher-ups in the Texas and federal government for help in canceling or delaying the new route. We should contact our representative and state senator and our U.S. congressman and tell all of them that not only is Presidio opposed to this, we don't have the infrastructure to handle it, Ponton added. At press time, city officials said they had not yet contacted U.S. lawmakers about Mexico's December announcement. Tony Gonzalez, the new U.S. representative for Texas 23, did not respond to a request for comment on the issue. At the meeting, Ferguson touched on a concern he's brought up for months. While officials in Chihuahua and Ojinaga make preparations, and while officials in Presidio try to do the same, it's been hard to get the attention of higher-ups in the United States, he said. I just find it really, really weird how information on the new route is all coming from Mexico, Ferguson said. Former Congressman Will Hurd, with whom Ferguson previously discussed the matter, had made little headway with the Mexican government before leaving office, Ferguson said. As the Big Bend Sentinel was going to press on Wednesday, Joe Biden took the oath as President of the United States. In an interview, Ferguson was hopeful that the new federal government would be more attuned to the ins and outs of U.S. and Mexico trade policy, including the Presidio Ojinaga transmigrant route. Former President Donald Trump wasn't about building bridges. He was about building walls, Ferguson told the Big Bend Sentinel. His interest in the border has been building walls and denying people entry. When it comes to transmigrants, though, Presidio city officials aren't exactly trying to build bridges either. One big concern is crime, as cartels in Mexico target transmigrants for bribes and merchandise. Cavazos, the Los Indios official, said transmigrants and Los Indios were frequent targets of Mexican criminals and that he felt sorry for them. And in a report on the transmigrants last year, a Mexican newspaper cited similar concerns from Mexican officials, with one official complaining that transmigrant brokers in Matamoros had corrupted this activity. At last week's meeting, Presidio City Administrator Joe Portillo said that the crime was likely one reason why Mexico wanted a new transmigrant route. Another likely reason, he said, was politics. It's an economic stimulus for Ojinaga, Portillo explained. It's a job opportunity for businesses that do that kind of export work. It would also bring new customers to other businesses in Ojinaga, from food vendors to car mechanics. Presidio officials may oppose the new route, but for brokers on both sides of the border, the mood is more ambivalent. A possible new parking lot development on U.S. 67 aims to profit from transmigrants looking for places to park. In recent weeks, brokers have reportedly had meetings with Portillo and other city officials to discuss preparations. Presidio city officials confirmed these meetings, but by press time, the Big Bend Sentinel was unable to get more information. Isela Nunez, a broker at Pro Customs Broker in Presidio, had mixed feelings on the new route. It would definitely be good for business and would leave some revenue in the city of Presidio, she said. At the same time, she shared officials' concerns about transmigrants, including traffic accidents, long waits at times of port, and lack of facilities for the merchants. I don't think we have the infrastructure to handle all the traffic that will come, she said. Gonzalez filled his tank at a Sunoco in Ozona on Friday night, making a short pit stop along I-10 on his way back from California. He was heading to Los Indios and eventually to his final destination in Belize. The transmigrant remarked that he hadn't heard Presidio Ojinaga was officially announced as a new route. He wasn't sure he would use it. I'll be honest with you, he said. The last time you spend in Mexico, the better, because Mexico is more dangerous than here. Traveling through Presidio could make the route to Central America slightly shorter, but for Gonzalez, a longer drive through the United States was worth it for the relative safety.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer, dated Thursday, January 14th, 2021. PCMH creates vaccine line. Staff report. Beginning this past week, Pecos County Memorial Hospital started a COVID-19 vaccine hotline for those wanting to get the Moderna vaccine who meet the Phase 1B criteria set out by the state of Texas. If you are age 65 or older, have medical conditions that put you at high risk, and would like to be on the COVID-19 vaccine waiting list, please call Pecos County Memorial Hospital's new COVID vaccine hotline at 432-336-4293 and leave your name and contact number. The conditions include, but are not limited to, cancer, chronic kidney disease, chronic obstruction pulmonary disease, heart conditions such as heart failure, coronary artery disease, and cardiomyopathies, solid organ transplantation, sickle cell disease. The hospital will call you back and schedule an appointment. Please do not call the clinic line. We will create our waiting list from messages left on the hotline. As of Monday, there were over 700 people who were on the waiting list. The time frame for the people on the waiting to get their vaccines have yet to be determined, according to Pecos County Memorial Hospital CEO Betsy Briscoe. The first 500 people in the county to receive their vaccine will begin to receive their second doses of the vaccine by the end of next week. The shipment of vaccines for those people are scheduled to arrive on January the 18th. For updates on the COVID-19 vaccine and all information regarding the virus in Pecos County, Check the Pioneer's website and Facebook pages, as well as the PCMH Facebook page. Gonzales Safeguards Oil and Gas Industry, contributed report. Congressman Tony Gonzales has signed on as an original co-sponsor to H.R. 218, the Saving America's Energy Future Act. This legislation, which was introduced on Wednesday by Congressman August Pfluger, prohibits the Biden administration from declaring a moratorium on issuing new oil and gas permits for drilling on federal lands. Also joining as co-sponsors are Representatives Stephanie Bice, Ronnie Jackson, Yvette Harrell, Brian Babin, Chip Roy, Dan Crenshaw, Pat Fallon, and Jody Arrington. It's no secret that Nancy Pelosi and the Biden administration are going to do everything they can to hamper Texas's energy industry, Congressman Gonzales said. We need to be doing everything in our power to protect these blue-collar jobs across the 23rd District. I'm looking forward to working with Congressman Pfluger to move forward this measure that will block Democrats from issuing a moratorium on new oil and gas leases and drill permits on federal lands. My primary concern in Congress is to protect our oil and gas industry from the radical Democrats who will soon control the House, Senate, and White House. Congressman Pfluger said President-elect Joe Biden campaigned on the promise to shut down drilling on all federal lands and phase out fossil fuels. This is in conjunction with ludicrous policies like the Green New Deal. Could mean the end to our oil and gas industry and the American economy as we know it. The Permian Basin produces over 40% of our nation's industry. This is clean, affordable, reliable energy that powers our nation, heats our homes, and allows us to defend ourselves. Energy security is national security, and nothing could be more important. The Permian Basin is the largest oil-producing region in the United States and home to over 200,000 jobs directly supported by the industry. United States natural gas and oil production has lifted over 1 billion people out of poverty over the last 10 years. The U.S. has also reduced the 6 key harmful pollutants by 77% since 1970, despite an energy increase of 48% due to a 285% increase in the GDP, a 60% population growth, and a 195% increase in miles traveled. Three more COVID-19 fatalities recorded by Nathan Hoer, Pioneer editor. Three additional COVID-19-related deaths were reported in Pecos County on Tuesday, January 12th, moving the death total in the county to 26. The three reported deaths were the most reported in a single day in the county since the start of the pandemic. The individuals that passed away were an 85-year-old male who was originally tested for the virus on November 29th and an 86-year-old male who was tested for COVID-19 on December 22nd. And was hospitalized at Midland Memorial Hospital. The 85-year-old male passed away on December 25th, and the 86-year-old male passed away on December 24th. Information was not provided regarding the third individual's death, but did occur on January 12th. Before Tuesday, Pecos County had not had a death since November 23. Despite the increase in deaths, active cases in Pecos County have stayed at 70 or lower since the start of the new On Tuesday, January 12th, there were 70 active cases reported after the number of active cases were in the 60s and 70s for the first 8 days of the new year. Hospitalizations continued to stay relatively high for Pecos County residents, as there were a total of 14 in the hospital due to COVID-19-related issues as of January 11th. There were two hospitalized at Pecos County Hospital, Memorial Hospital, on January 11th and 12th, and 12 Pecos County hospitals hospitalized statewide. Since January 6, there have been 78 new cases in the county, moving the total number to positive tests to start the pandemic to 919. There have been 3,954 tests administered in Pecos County since the start of the pandemic. As of Tuesday, there were 50 tests pending. A total of 823 Pecos County residents have recovered from COVID-19, and 172 out of the county have recovered. A total of 186 people tested positive for the virus at Pecos County Healthcare Facility, but live out of the county. The Fort Stockton Independent School District began the week with teachers having an in-service day on Monday, January 11th, and the students returning on January 12th. FSISD Superintendent Gilray Madrid reported on the morning of Wednesday, January 13th, there were 3 active COVID-19 cases within the district, 2 of those being students and 1 being a staff member. The 1 staff member is a teacher at one of the district's elementary schools. The additional active cases increases the total number of FISD students who have tested positive for COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic to 40, and the total number of teachers to 34. Nearly 9% of staff members have tested positive, as there are 379 staff members who work for the FSISD. Donna Saul celebrates 80th birthday at the NFR. By Nathan Heuer. In 1977, Donna Saul made history by becoming the only person from Fort Stockton to qualify for the National Finals Rodeo, doing so in barrel racing by becoming one of the top 15 money winners in the country in the event. In the 1959 Fort Stockton High School graduate was able to take a trip down memory lane in December when her dear friends Bob and Nancy Hader bought her tickets to the event that was held in Arlington, Texas at Globe Life Field, home to the Texas Rangers. For Saul, it was the first time she had attended an NFR event since she competed in 77. "I loved it," she said. "It was quite something to actually be there and see all the actual people. Brought back a lot of good memories." Fort Stockton's only NFR qualifier to this day grew up in Fort Stockton on the West Powell Ranch, working for the ranch as a hand with her parents and brother. Her love for horses began at an early age, as her dad, Philip, had her on a saddle as soon as she was big enough. "Daddy carried me around with him before I learned how to ride by myself. As soon as I learned to ride by myself, I was hardly ever off a horse till 7 or 8 years ago, competing the competition in barrel racing and goat tying did not come until she attended Solros University and had her horse at the time, Yeller, a Palomino, trained to compete. But long before she competed, the Fort Stockton resident had a natural gift when it came to goat tying. Nancy shared a story about a time on the ranch involving goats when Saul was working for her husband, Bob. "Bob will tell you she's the best goat roper in the country. He loves to tell a story about there was a bunch of sheep at the pen, and all of a sudden something happened, and they went over the top of them. I think she roped 20 or about of his too," Nancy said. Saul went on to win the collegiate and finals in goat tying in 61 and 62 before shifting her focus to barrel racing later in her rodeo career. Barrel racing was rather a foreign thing to Saul when she graduated high school, and after learning at Saul Ross, she competed with her horse Yeller for many years before switching to the horse she made it to the NFR with, Skeeter. "I hardly even knew what a barrel race was when I was in high school because we never went anywhere to rodeo," she said. "In college, they helped me train my first horse, Yeller. He was a Palomino and just started calling him Yeller. Then I got the horse I went to the finals on in Van Horn. My brother raised horses, and he gave me a colt, Skeeter, and that's the one I went to the national finals on. They were both quarter horses." After competing in the NFR in 1977, Saul continued to barrel race into the 90s, riding at local rodeos and a barrel racing organization out of Odessa in Midland. Area engineer hired at for Fort Stockton office. Thing Pin On, P.E., has been appointed as the new area engineer for the Fort Stockton area office. In his new role, Thing Pin will oversee design and construction operations in Pecos, Reeves, and Terrell counties. He also will supervise maintenance sections in Fort Stockton, Iran, Balmoray, Pecos, and Sanderson. "I'm excited to add Thing Pin On to our team in the Odessa district of TxDOT," said District Engineer John Speed. "He brings a wealth of experience with him to serve the southern half of the district. Feng Pin joined Ford Motor Company after graduating from the University of Texas in Austin with a bachelor's in mechanical engineering in 1999. After working on new product launches and production system improvements, he returned to school to earn his master's in civil engineering from Texas A&M in 2003. He started his TxDOT career in the San Angelo District with the Sonora area office, gaining experience in both the Galveston and North Turret area offices before earning his professional engineering license in 2007. He joined the district lab in the Houston district, where his projects included design of drill shaft foundations for the connector at US 59 and Beltway 8. Feng Pin On has experience with rural West Texas from his experience in the Sonora area office, but he also brings experience with working with large project loads from his time in the Houston and Fort Worth districts. He will have to draw from all of that to address the issues facing the Odessa district. Feng Pin On has a history of civil service. Between the late 2019 and 2011, Feng Pin took a sabbatical to teach English in a village in Taiwan, where he was recognized for his volunteer efforts by the Taiwan Department of Interior. After returning to Houston, Feng Pin joined TxDOT's central design team working on the completing design of US 59 and IH 69 and the US 290 Segment 12 widening project. In late 2015, he became the lead design engineer in the Montgomery area office, supervising the design performed in the area office and supporting construction activities in the area. He became the assistant area engineer in the Fort Bend office in July 2016, managing several regionally significant reconstruction projects on US 59, IH 69, and on the IH 10 Texas Clear Lanes widening project. While in this position, he worked on the improvements in customer experience and office operations. Feng Pin and his wife, Kumi, have a 2-year-old daughter and a newborn daughter.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, January 14th. Randy Crabtree elected new fire chief, mayor, and 2 council seats up for election. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. During the first regularly scheduled city council meeting of 2021, the council approved the election of officers for the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department for the new year. This year's election was a little different from the past few years, as members of the department were tasked with electing a new chief after the recent retirement of longtime Fire Chief Eddie Nelms. Nelms announced his retirement from the department on December 31st. At the time, Nelms said, quote, "The city has grown so much, and there are so many more calls now, it was becoming more like a full-time job. I want to be able to spend more time with my family and focus more on my county job. I am hurting over this decision, but for me and my family, it is the right call to make," end quote. Members of the fire department met on Monday, January 11th, to elect the officers, and council action ratified that election. Quote, "We are very fortunate to have such outstanding personnel in our fire department," Mayor David Cutberth said. Officers for 2021 are Fire Chief Randy Crabtree, Assistant Chief Seth Davis, First Captain Cody Jimenez, Second Captain Roy Garcia, Third Captain Ben McElfrey, and Fourth Captain and Secretary Treasurer Roy Bean. As Fire Chief, Crabtree will earn a salary of $400 a month from the city. The salary was increased from $200 in October 2018. The firemen also elected Leroy Case as president, Aaron Higgs as vice president, and Cody Murphy as chaplain. Trustees Melvin Kraft, whose term expires January 2022, and Roy Bean, whose term expires January 2023. One additional trustee will be elected at the next fire meeting on Monday, January 18th, to serve a 3-year term. The council also ratified these appointments. City Manager Rex Thee thanked Nelms for all his accomplishments while serving as fire chief. Along with Thee and Cutberth, council members Jeppy Wilson, Rudy Hernandez, and Ivy Valenzuela were present for the meeting. Council member Richard Hawkins and City Attorney Alan Nicholas were absent. In other business, the council voted to hold the required election for city officials on Saturday, May 1st, as required by law. This year, the mayor and council positions number 2 and 3 are up for election. Council member and mayoral elections are held every 2 years. According to city records, Monahans Council hasn't had a contested council seat race since 2007, when Rob Robinson ran for the council member District 3 position, then occupied by Ken Bayned. Bayned resigned from the post in February 2019, leaving the post open. Naomi DeAnda, Raul Rudy Sesteda, and Calvin Carroll all registered for the seat. Carroll won the District 3 post with 142 votes of the 221 cast. Jeppy Wilson occupies the District 2 seat, and David Cutberth is currently mayor. T.J. Price ran for the mayoral position in 2017 against Cutberth. The council's incumbent seat holders, Jeppy Wilson and Calvin Carroll, have been in office 24 and 2 years respectively, and Mayor David Cutberth has been in office for 28 years. Citizens who wish to run for either the mayor or council position must be a U.S. citizen, resident of Monahans, qualified to vote, a bona fide taxpayer, cannot hold another public office or employment, and must live in the district in which they wish to run. The mayor's position is paid $50 a month with taxes withheld, and council members are paid $10 per meeting, but not more than $25 per month, Todd said. Quote, all three incumbents have already filed their intentions to run for re-election, Todd added. The election will be held at the MWP ISD Administration Building, 606 South Betty Avenue. Forms are available at City Hall for citizens who may wish to run for one of the positions. Deadline to file is February 12th. COVID-19 death toll rises in county. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The number of deaths and active cases of the COVID-19 coronavirus continues to increase. Since last Wednesday, the number of deaths has increased from 9 to 12, and the number of active cases has increased from 65 to 150. On Tuesday, the active case count was 117. Several cases have been reported at focused care of Monahans, but no information is available as to the number of affected residents or any deaths. The Moderna vaccine is starting to be received at Ward Memorial Hospital, and dispensing will begin late this week, early next week. 100 doses have been received. An allocation of another 900 has been approved for the hospital and clinics, but receipt is unknown. Monahans Pharmacy dispensed 100 doses last week, but it is not known when additional doses will be received. To get on the waiting list, residents should call the hospital at 432-943-2511. The priorities for those wanting the vaccine are 1. Frontline healthcare workers, 2. Persons over 65 years of age, and 3. Persons 16 to 64 years of age who have underlying health conditions. As of Wednesday morning, there were 353,000 active cases in Texas, with 1.7 million confirmed and 30,000 deaths. Went Clear County to get overpass. Highway 302 will span both Highway 115 and Railroad. A project to build an overpass on Highway 302 to go over Highway 115 and the railroad just west of Kermit is scheduled to begin January 19th. The project will include a little more than a mile of service roads to provide access to properties and to allow traffic to access Highway 115. Quote, "This intersection is a critical location for energy development," said Odessa District Engineer John Speed. "Traffic counts in the area have more than doubled since 2015, and the current four-way stop condition is no longer viable. The project will dramatically reduce the risk of vehicle crashes. It will also decrease the current delays experienced while moving personnel, equipment, and sand proppants between the Delaware Basin and centers of mining and other resources to the east." End quote. The $54 million project is partially funded by a $25 million federal grant allocated through the Better Utilizing Investments to Leverage Development, or BUILD grant program managed by the U.S. Department of Transportation. The remainder of the cost is being funded through energy sector funding set aside by the Texas Transportation Commission that oversees the Texas Department of Transportation. The Permian Road Safety Coalition also donated $40,000 to the project. Quote, "Local governments, citizens, businesses, and organizations such as MOTRAN, the Permian Strategic Partnership, and the Permian Road Safety Coalition played a significant role during the BUILD grant application process," Speed said. Continuing the quote, "Their statements of support and provision of key data were instrumental in demonstrating the need for the project and in ultimately receiving the grant," end quote. The project is scheduled to take about 2 years to complete. Several major changes in traffic flow will occur at different phases of the project. Motorists can check out current conditions at www.drivetexas.org. Updates will also be released as news releases and on the Odessa District Twitter page at text.odessa. Restrictions on oversized loads and a reduction in speed limit will be used to improve safety in the project area. Motorists should pay close attention to signage in the area. Changes could affect both Highway 302 and Highway 115. Increased law enforcement is likely to be in place at times for the project. Delays are expected throughout the project. Motorists are asked to find alternate routes if possible. Motorists are also reminded that state law requires them to obey any flaggers or warning signs encountered in the work zone. Kiewit Infrastructure South Company of Fort Worth won the project with a low bid of $54.4 million. For more information, contact Gene Powell at gene.powell@texdot.gov or call 432-498-4746. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on January 14th. Elgin Ray Punk Jones, age 93, passed away on Saturday, January 2nd, at his home in Mentone. He was born September 25th, 1927, in Coleman County, to William Lafayette and Odie Martha Seneker Jones. Elgin married Mary Bell Stedham on June 7th, 1950, in Ibex Community, and they shared 70 years together. Punk, as he was known to friends and family, was a hard-working man. He always had at least two jobs and rarely sat still for very long. He was a lifelong rancher and took his stewardship of the land very seriously. Punk and Mary Bell started P&M Ranch in 1953 and grew it into a successful family business. Punk was a veteran of the U.S. Army and served law enforcement for over 30 years. During his life, he worked as a cowboy for many ranches, He spent 28 years serving as the sheriff in Loving County, 13 years working for Sinclair Oil and Gas. Punk is survived by his loving wife, Mary Bell Jones of Mentone, children Skeet Jones and wife Barbara of Mentone, Ramona Moore and husband Stan of Amarillo, Tom Jones and wife Karen of Mobidi, Texas, Richard Jones of Mentone, and Mozill Carr and husband John of Mentone. He is also survived by many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Funeral services were held Saturday, January 9th, at the Mentone School Gym with Brother Monty Huffman officiating. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Sunset International Bible Institute Missionary Fund. Arrangements are entrusted to Family Services Funeral Parlor of Kermit, and condolences may be sent to the family online at www.fs-fp.com. Oscar Vasquez Rodriguez, beloved husband, father, brother, grandfather, uncle, passed away on January 8th. Oscar was born to the late Manuel and Gloria Rodriguez on May 17th, 1954, and was raised in Pecos. Oscar is survived by his loving wife, Estella, and his children, Christy Marie Munoz, Andrew Michael Rodriguez, Oscar Vincent Rodriguez, Elizabeth Aaron Rodriguez, Vivian Carrasco, as well as many grandchildren. Left to cherish his memories are his brothers and sisters, Juan Rodriguez, Tencha Ward, Lisa Ann Lara, Daniel Martinez, Alita Rodriguez, Anna Mary Madrid, Samuel Martinez, Isabel Bobby Falcon, Joey Martinez, Ricardo Martinez, and numerous nieces and nephews. A funeral mass will be held Friday, January 15th at 10 a.m. at St. John Evangelist Catholic Church in Monahans with Father Alan Alaka officiating. Burial will follow in Pecos at Mount Evergreen Cemetery at 1 p.m. Condolences may be mailed to Post Office Box 1881, Pecos, Texas, 79772. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or to leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Christina Renee Weldy, also known as Skitlitz and Poof, age 38 of Monahans, gained her wings on December 27th. She was born on March 15th, 1982, in Kermit, to Jim Weldy and Georgie Davis. Christina is survived by her loving children, Taylor Marion Bryant, Isaiah Anthony Bryant of Lackey, Missouri, father, Jimmy Weldy of Monahans, mother, Georgie Davis of Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, sister Robin Miranda of Winston, New Mexico, brother Jonathan Weldy of Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, step-grandmother Linda Weldy of Monahans, and several aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or to leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements were under the care of Harkey Funeral Home. Santa V. Maldonado passed away on January 7th at her home in Monahans. Santa was born on November 1st, 1928, in Sanderson, to Felicito and San Juan Valles. After growing up in Langtree, Santa married Valentin A. Maldonado on October 24th, 1949, in Midland. She lived in Sanderson for several years before residing in Monahans until her death. Santa is survived by her son, Robert V. Maldonado, and wife Elma, daughter Gloria Leticia Maldonado, brother Joe Borrego and wife Fidela, sisters Mabel Rubalcava, Amelia Escamilla, and husband Press, as well as grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Viewing was held on Monday, January 11th, at Harkey Funeral Home, the rosary followed at St. John Catholic Church. The funeral mass following was also held on January 11th at St. John Catholic Church in Monahans, with Father Alan Alaka officiating. Burial followed at Monahans Memorial Cemetery. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or to leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Robert Bob Allen Whiteman of Streetman passed away January 4, 2021, in Mahia at the age of 82. Bob was born January 10, 1938, in Tappan, Ohio, to Frank Lee and Goldie Marie Wiles Whiteman, the fourth of five children. Bob was very proud of his long career with TU Electric. He worked at Texas Electric in Monahans from 1960 to 1971. He was preceded in death by his parents, Frank and Goldie Whiteman, and by his son, Robert Bobby Whiteman, Jr. Bob is survived by his wife, Judith Wardle of Streetman, daughter, Dana Beth Whiteman Rogers, and husband, William Allen of Teague, granddaughter, Anna Beth Rogers of Teague. A private graveside service was held at the Birdston Cemetery near Streetman on January 6th. Memorials may be made to the charity of your choice. Please visit www.blair-stubbs.com to leave the family a message of condolence or to sign the guest book. Rosalind Bowen, age 79, passed away on January 3rd. She was born in Odessa on May 24, 1941. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Esperanza Holguin, age 70, of Monahans, passed away on Sunday, January 10th. She was born in Monahans on April 13th, 1950. Rosary to take place at St. John's Evangelist Catholic Church at 6 p.m. on Monday, January 18th. Funeral Mass will be held at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, January 19th, at St. John's Evangelist Catholic Church. Burial will follow. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Esther Polanco, age 71, passed away in Odessa on January 10th. Rosary for Esther is Thursday, January 14th at 1 p.m., with Mass to follow at 2 p.m. at St. John's Evangelist Catholic Church. Burial will follow immediately at Monahans Memorial Cemetery. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.